Today we will talk with John Abromeit. John Abromeit is Associate Professor in History at the Buffalo State University of New York. He specialized on modern European intellectual history, German history, critical social theory. And his book, Max Horkheimer and the Foundations of the Frankfurt School, was published at the Cambridge University Press in 2011, and it received great attention and acclaim. He is also, what is particularly interesting here for our context, for our conversation, he is also the editor of Transformations of Populism in Europe and the Americas, History and Recent Tendencies, and it was published in 2016 and received also great interest, so that there will be now a paperback edition. We will talk about the situation, the constellation of authoritarianism, racism, and social boundaries in the United States. There it seems that since spring, the extremely worrying course of the pandemic has become entangled, became entangled with the intensification of racist practices of social segregation. And in our conversation, we will talk about the question of how this specific crisis constellation of the permanence of racism and social boundaries is at the same time characterized by an upsurge of authoritarian forms of acting, which have reached a hitherto unknown dominance. And here the question arises, to what extent a theoretical concept that has dealt decisively with the analysis and critique of the authoritarian personality, how far this kind of concept of the classical critical theory of society can also be productive in order to better understand and analyze this current forms of authoritarianism, not only in the USA. So I come to my first question concerning this entanglement of social and questions and racism. John, with the pandemic, US society has also experienced a vehement confrontation with racism, racist practices of demarcation. At the same time, a new resistance against such racism has emerged. My question is, to what extent does this new anti-racist resistance reflect the relationship between social exclusion, social inequality, and racism?
All right. Well, thanks for inviting me to do this interview, Ninad. I would say that the new protests, which we've seen emerge since the murder by the police of George Floyd in Minnesota, and of course, he wasn't the only one. In Georgia, a young African-American man was also murdered by a father and a son with a shotgun, Ahmed Arbery. And another case which has gotten a lot of attention in the U.S. media, and rightfully so, was Breonna Taylor in Lexington, Kentucky, who was murdered by police who broke into her apartment and shot her to death. So I think these protests have focused on the deep structural racism that exists in the United States, and deep continuities of racism that have persisted since the origins, really, of American society. And so there's been a number of books published recently that have examined these continuities of structural racism in the United States. For example, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, makes an argument about how mass incarceration, which disproportionately affects African-American, also Latino men, is in some way a continuation of slavery and Jim Crow laws that had existed during earlier phases of American history. Another book that's gotten a lot of attention recently is called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. And the author's name is Isabel Wilkerson. She's written a previous book on the Great Migration, when many hundreds of thousands, millions of African Americans moved from the South to the North in the 1920s and 1930s. But her new book, Caste, it's also arguing that there are these very deep continuities of structural racism that persist into the present and continue to determine the structures, the important aspects of American society. So I think that protesters have also examined relationships between racism and social inequality, as you were asking about in the question. And people have also looked at how African Americans and Latinos have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic. The rates of death among African Americans and Latinos has been quite significantly higher than it has among whites. And part of that is simply because of class, that more African Americans and Latinos work in jobs which put them in danger of exposure to COVID. So a higher percentage of whites work in professional jobs where they are able to work at home via computer, whereas that's not the case if you are a bus driver or a nurse, or you have different blue-collar jobs working in a grocery store and so on. Then you are forced to put yourself. And this certainly also, this link between race and class is reflected in the higher rates of transmission. So I think that, you know, there has been a certain amount of reflection upon this, but I think rightfully so, there's been more emphasis on examining structural racism in the United States. And I think that that's important because so many white Americans have not really engaged and haven't become fully aware of the extent to which, you know, structural racism has always shaped American society and continues to shape American society. Now, that being said, many commentators have noticed that there have been a lot of white protesters involved in the anti-racist protests, especially many young white racist anti-racist protesters. In fact, I'm sure you probably heard about the young white man who was killed by a far-right radical in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who was protesting against the racism of the police department in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and was killed. So this is just one example of, I think, you know, what many commentators have noticed as a multiracial, you know, coalition among the protesters. So, and there have also been certain commentators, African-American intellectuals, who have commented upon this. Somebody like Kianga Yamata Taylor, who is an important professor at Princeton, who's written a book called From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, has always has a more, say, socialist approach to some of these issues, and someone who has been critical of a kind of neoliberal identity politics, which, you know, she, one of the chapters of her book is called Black Faces in High Places, right? So she has a critique of, say, the Obama administration and the idea that if we can just get a few more black faces in high places, this is going to solve the deeper underlying problems in American society, right? Or someone like Cornel West, who has been a member of Democratic Socialists of America for many, many years, also a very sharp critic of Obama in the sense that, you know, having black faces in high places isn't going to address the, it may be one step in that direction, but we still certainly have a long ways to go in terms of addressing, you know, massive inequalities in wealth. I mean, you know, on average, studies have shown that white families have about 10 times as much wealth, if not more, 10 or 12 times as much wealth as African-American families. And, you know, that statistic is skewed to a certain extent because there are so many extremely wealthy white families. But, you know, one of the legacies of the history of structural racism in the United States has been to prevent black families from accumulating wealth, for example, by forcing them to live in neighborhoods where their houses don't accumulate as much value as white families through racist zoning laws or lending laws, you know, redlining, housing covenants, this sort of thing. So I think that these are some of the issues that have been discussed recently as a result of the protests.
Yeah, thank you very much, John, for this insight. As we have three questions in this kind of format of our interview, let me come now to the second one. I mean, this is more a kind of observation I would like to share with you and to ask you for your impressions concerning this issue. I mean, it's about kind of protests we observe in many places around the world against not Corona, but against the Corona measures. And for a long time, within this context, in a Foucauldian tradition, the analysis of discourses of control generated by the state actors was at the forefront in explaining the problematic identification of migration, migrants as potential bearers of viruses and triggers of epidemics. And the state is seen as a protagonist of the internalization of such perceptions that set migration and epidemic identical. It then appears that such discourses infiltrate all social segments, are internalized by the single individuals, and these are transformed into agents of such comprehensive control obsession. So far, this Foucauldian perspective. But I mean, what I'm wondering about is that we currently are experienced that in that political and social segment in which the emergence of a block warden, block wart mentality could potentially be expected, and which was maybe in Germany still very visible until the 1970s, that this actually has not occurred. So far, there is no mass denunciation mania that would, for example, eagerly report private parties in apartments or any form of non-pandemic compliant behavior during the lockdown to the police, or that would link the anti-immigrant incitement to the pandemic. On the contrary, especially in the context of authoritarian movements in which the dispositions towards fear projections are present, which would result in the persecution of alleged virus carriers, an apparently opposite reaction comes into play. Thousands of people take into the streets to protest against the rules for containing the pandemic, which in their opinion do not even exist. And many of these people continue to rush against migrants. That's absolutely true. But so far, at least, no explicit link has been made between epidemics and immigrants within this current, because they say there is no pandemic. So how can one explain the fact that authoritarian movements seem to demonstrate against state control mania and for freedom? Is such, to call it conformist rebellion, an aggressive reflex to the fact that society has changed massively, no longer corresponding to traditional hierarchies and legitimation of domination? Is it actually about the loss of control? How would you assess this phenomenon, John?
Okay. Well, I think it's a very interesting question. And I did live in Germany for 6 years when I was younger. But I would like to speak more directly now to the United States. And perhaps you have some observations that you'd like to make about Germany. But I'd like to also make some somewhat more theoretical observations here in order to try to answer this question of, you know, why a Foucauldian analysis, which seems to focus too much on the state repression, you know, Foucault's famous critique of power, that power is centralized and that, you know, resistance to power takes the form of local resistance. And I think this also reflects a certain understanding of fascism, which may or may not be true, right? The idea that fascism too was a state-centric form of domination, and that's the way we should understand fascism. Because I think one of the interesting things that has happened with the resurgence of right-wing populism in both Europe and the United States is that I think we've been forced also to rethink how we understand fascism, and the fact that fascism itself, of course, in its origins, was a right-wing populist movement, right? And which, at least in the beginning, certainly claimed to also oppose the state. And then, well, of course, when fascism comes to power, it takes a control of the state. But I want to talk more about the American society, and I also want to draw upon my own research on early Frankfurt School of critical theory, and on the authoritarian personality in particular. Theodor Adorno was, of course, one of the co-authors of the authoritarian personality. And in his essay on tradition, Über Tradition, Adorno refers to the United States as a radical bourgeois society, right? And in the authoritarian personality, Adorno also develops the concept of pseudo-conservatism. And I think that these two concepts of the United States as a radical bourgeois society and then Adorno's concept of pseudo-conservatism in the authoritarian personality are still very useful in trying to make sense of some of these more recent developments in the United States with Trump and Trump's election and the form that radical right-wing thinking has assumed in the United States in the past decade or so, right? So I think that, in the United States, right-wing populists appeal to traditions of radical individualism, right? So these are imagined traditions, of course, but they are very real for these people. And so from this point of view, government mandates to wear masks, to social distance, not to gather indoors, are seen as a form of potential totalitarianism, right? A violation of what they see as their own constitutional, and certainly they would say God-given rights, right? These people often would link the Constitution to a kind of Christian nationalism, right? This sort of sees, the Constitution as a Christian document. But, there's this famous flag that from the early days of the American Constitution, that it says, don't tread on me, right? So I think this is a symbol of the idea of a kind of radical individualism, a libertarianism that is so powerful among these different groups has remained and is, but I think one of the things Adorno does in authoritarian personality is he tries to show how these imagined traditions, which seem so libertarian, can actually be transformed, umschlagen, right, into authoritarianism, right? And another concept that's very interesting that he discusses there is what he calls the usurpation complex, right? And this idea that the whole sphere of politics and government is a parasitic sphere, right? And that politicians represent parasites and they shouldn't be given too much power, really, because we would like to have people who are really in charge, who get things done. We really should be giving power to the people who have the real power in society, right? Now, so someone like Donald Trump, he, campaigned claiming that he was a businessman. He's never had anything to do with politics. He will come in and run government like a business, right? And so the idea is that, he will implement these sort of radical liberal traditions, the tradition of business and free enterprise, right? And that politics will be put in its place, right? And so people will identify with a candidate who makes these types of claims, who claims to represent this radical liberal or radical bourgeois traditions in the United States. Defending the free market, unhampered economic growth, opposing unions. Unions are seen as artificially raising the price of labor, which is a free market. It's not a fair thing to do. Low taxes, right? One of the things Adorno points out, too, in the authoritarian personality is that even progressive and more left-leaning Americans are opposed to, high taxes, right? There's this attitude that people should be able to make as much money as they want, right? This is the American dream, the story of the Horatio Alger story of going from rags to riches. And no one should put any restrictions upon this freedom to make as much. And Adorno even says this is a kind of closest thing that we have to utopia in American society is the utopia of individual with unlimited wealth, right? And I think he correctly calls this a kind of childish utopia. I mean, just coming back to the issue of immigrants, I think that, you know, you raise the question of why haven't immigrants been targeted? They don't seem to be attacked as the bearers of the coronavirus, which we might have expected, right? Because as a continuation of the important xenophobic dimensions of right-wing populism in Europe and the United States, I think that in the United States, illegal immigrants are seen in right-wing discourses as being parasites for the most part. You know, the concern is that the immigrants are illegal, right? That they're living off the state, right? That they're somehow parasitic. They're taking away jobs from the productive members of society. And interestingly, this this plays into another very common right-wing ideological, you know, trope of the welfare queen, right? The black mother who has children and who's not working and who's living off of, you know, the taxpayers' money, right? So, you know, part of American, this kind of right-wing liberalism is also this whole idea of the producers and the parasites, right? That goes very deep into liberal ideology. But I think that, so, you know, there's this, you know, accusation that immigrants aren't contributing, when in reality, of course, many of these illegal immigrants are contributing massively. You know, we think of all of the immigrant workers in the Central Valley in California who do this backbreaking labor of harvesting, you know, produce in the Central Valley and are getting paid less than minimum wage. I mean, you know, our entire, you know, so much of American society is dependent upon these illegal workers. And if they didn't exist, the price of our produce would double, right? And so people wouldn't be very happy about paying twice as much for their produce. But at the same time, many of these same people complain about so-called illegal immigrants, right? But also, you know, one of the consequences of neoliberal policies in the United States since the 1980s has been a massive shift of wealth from rural areas into urban, large urban areas. So in the past 30 to 40 years, you know, a lot of jobs have disappeared in rural areas and in small towns in the so-called red states of the United States. And one recent study by a Princeton economist by the name of Angus Deaton and Anne Case, two Princeton professors. It's called Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. It documents how life expectancy among whites with no college education has declined by about 7 or 8 years in the past 20 years, right? And this is a more dramatic decline than any other demographic group in the United States. So, and these deaths of despair, as they call them, are due to drug overdoses, suicide, alcoholism, all factors that reflect a kind of despair that's resulted from changing socioeconomic conditions in the United States, which, you know, ironically also reflects earlier tendencies that existed in among African Americans, say in the 1970s and 80s, when lots of inner city manufacturing jobs were lost, and this led to higher rates of crime and despair, drug abuse among African American countries. Now, this something similar is now happening in white rural areas, but of course one has to ask how much this is due to larger changes in the global economy as well. Now, one other point, too, is that Trump himself has played into xenophobic stereotypes by labeling the coronavirus a Chinese virus, right? And so Trump has, from the beginning, created a xenophobic anti-Chinese discourse, has blamed the Chinese for American economic problems, has sought to introduce tariffs. And so in the early phases of the pandemic, there were incidences of Chinese Americans, you know, being targeted, attacked verbally or physically by people who were acting on this anti-Chinese rhetoric that was being propagated from the White House.
Of course, you mentioned Adorno and authoritarian personality. And that would be for me now the question then, I mean, this was written about more than half a century ago. The book is now really a 70-year-old book, so to say. It has the 70th anniversary or something like this. And on the other side, we see that there is some kind what Alfred Schmidt has always pointed out from Frankfurt, the philosopher from Frankfurt, the Zeitkern of critical theory, the time course, so that how what has changed? It is simply enough to read authoritarian personality today, or how have we to approach this text, and how can it tell really something about the situation today? So this would be my last question to you then.
Well, I think it's a good question. And of course, you know, in Dialect of Enlightenment, Horkheimer and Adorno do talk about die Zeitkern der Wahrheit. And this is what Alfred Schmidt is referring to. And I believe that is absolutely central to critical theory. In some of my own work, I describe critical theory, the method of critical theory, as a critical historicism, right? So it's not a historicism in the sense of someone like Ranke who wants to tell us wie es eigentlich gewesen ist, right? But it's a reflexive historicism which reflects upon the social and historical conditions within which it theorizes, right? And this is a basic component not only of critical theory, but of any genuinely dialectical thinking, right? Being self-reflexive in this way. So of course, as Horkheimer always insisted, why is it that Horkheimer always insisted on carrying out empirical research projects? Because the intention of empirical research projects was to keep the theoretical concepts in touch with the present day reality, right? So this is why of course, the critical theorists were never subscribed to a naive notion of empiricism. But on the other hand, empirical research was crucial because, you know, a purely normative or rationalist approach can, you know, very easily lose touch with historical developments and historical change, right? So, yes, I think authoritarian personality does need to be updated. But I think that part of reflecting upon historical conditions is also being aware of deeper continuities that exist, right, in certain periods or epochs, right? So I would certainly argue we are still living in what Horkheimer called the bourgeois epoch, right? I mean, we're still living in a capitalist society, and we need to periodize capitalism from within, right? So the critical theorists, they spoke of the shift from liberal to monopoly to state capitalism, right? So liberal capitalism being in the mid-19th century to the later 19th century, which is then taken over by monopoly capitalism, you know, which Lenin even also describes in his writings on imperialism, to later on in the 1930s to state capitalism, right? Where you see different forms of state-centric capitalism emerging, first in the Soviet Union with the five-year plans and socialism in one country, but then also in Nazi Germany, in the United States. You know, Wolfgang Schievelbusch has written this fascinating book, Entfernte Verwandtschaften, I believe, in which he compares these different forms of state capitalism, right? And this is the same idea that Pollock uses in his essay on state capitalism, which had such a big impact on Horkheimer and Adorno. And I think that when we think about authoritarian personality, which was, you know, the research was carried out in the late 40s, it's published in 1949 or 1950. It was the study was done during the period of Fordism, you know, turning into high Fordism in the United States, in which, you know, Keynesian economic policies were dominant in the United States. The classical liberal economic free market policies were seen as being discredited by the Great Crash of 1929 and the Great Depression, right? So there was a consensus that nobody wanted to go back and try to apply the methods of classical liberalism. Herbert Hoover had tried that in the early 30s, just like Brüning did it, you know, in Germany in the early 30s, and it failed miserably, right? It just made things much worse. And so when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected in 1932, he begins to introduce policies of state government intervention in the economy, right? And was very quite successful with this over the long term. This is the so-called New Deal policies, right, which, used Keynesian methods of government borrowing in order to create jobs, which massively raised taxes. I mean, few people realize, but during World War II, the tax bracket for the wealthiest Americans was over 90%. So, you know, the wealthiest Americans had to give over 90% of their profits into the government. And people agreed to do this, right? This is part of a consensus that, you know, the stronger people, it was a period of crisis and people had to contribute, right? And in the post-war period too, the Republican presidents in the United States, including Eisenhower, didn't diverge from these policies. You know, I mean, the tax rates did go down, but the basic idea that there should be a social state in place and that the government should intervene, the same thing that happens in post-war Western Europe, right, with you know, the construction of a strong welfare state in the UK, in France, in Germany. This is all a product of the post-World War II period. So I think that when Horkheimer and Adorno, when Horkheimer wrote the preface to the Studies in Prejudice, right, which, you know, the authoritarian personality was part of a larger five-volume study of Studies in Prejudice, right? And Horkheimer said in his preface that the conditions for right-wing populism are not very good right now because the United States has just defeated fascism in World War II. Fascism and right-wing populist, you know, movements have been discredited, you know, and so that's part of it. Also, the fact that the United States and Western Europe were at the beginning of a period of unprecedented prosperity, right? The Wirtschaftswunder in Germany, right? The Les Trente Glorieuses, right? In France, and the, what Eric Hobsbawm called the Golden Age, right? In his history of the world in the 20th century. But as we all know, this, you know, comes to an end in the 1970s with the economic downturn in the 1970s, the inability of Keynesian methods to address the economic problems that existed, which then led in turn to a rehabilitation of neoliberal policies. You know, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman both win Nobel Prizes in economics in the 1970s. Thatcher is elected in Britain in 1979. Reagan is elected. They introduced these new neoliberal policies, which then, you know, have been more or less in place since then, and which, as Thomas Piketty showed, have led to increasing inequality, massive transfer of wealth upward into the top 10%, 1%, 1%, you know, percent of the 1%, right? So a massive transfer of wealth upward, increased inequality, increased precarity, right? The famous study by the British sociologist Guy Standing, the precariat, you know, which got so much attention as a reflection of the new economic uncertainty, right, that exists in neoliberal societies. And so my point is that these changing socioeconomic conditions, increased inequality, increased precarity, have created fertile ground for right-wing populist movements. And I think that, you know, it's not a coincidence that, you know, as the Dutch political scientist Cas Mudde has pointed out, that the right-wing populism was the only new family of parties to emerge in Europe in the 1980s and 1990s. And right-wing populist parties emerge during the same period of neoliberal reforms in Europe. So I think we have to think about the connection, you know, between right-wing populism and neoliberalism more carefully, right? Now, in terms of the authoritarian personality and critical theory, I think that, you know, I talked earlier about the concept of pseudo-conservatism. Well, pseudo-conservatism as a form of radical liberalism was also discredited by the new consensus on Keynesian policies, right? And the idea that radical liberalism was discredited by the Great Depression in the United States. But once that consensus was itself seemingly discredited in the 1970s, right, in the 1980s, it creates a new fertile ground for a reemergence of what Adorno called pseudo-conservatism in the United States. And you know, with Trump, this has attained its most extreme form because Trump is somebody like nobody in the history of the United States who encourages these types of movements, right? I mean, before Trump was elected, you had the Tea Party movement, which emerged in the midterm elections in 2010 as a critique and response to the Obama presidency, but the Tea Party movement always saw itself as a decentralized movement. And then when Trump was elected, the Tea Party movement, in a sense, got a leader, an authoritarian leader, right? And so I think that these tendencies that have always existed in American society have been strongly encouraged by Trump. And I think this has something to do with the changing socioeconomic conditions in the United States. Now, one other point that I think is important too, in terms of critical theory, is that in the 1930s, the critical theorist analyzed fascism as a product of liberal tendencies, right? And so there's a reflection upon how did liberal capitalism transform into or give rise to fascist movements. You know, one sees this, for example, in Herbert Marcuse's 1934 essay, The Struggle Against Liberalism in the Totalitarian View of the State, or also Horkheimer's famous statement, you know, who doesn't want to talk about capitalism should also be silent, remain silent about fascism. Like, so saying that we can't talk about fascism unless we talk about capitalism too, right? Now this, in the 1930s though, this is before Horkheimer had adopted the state capitalism thesis by Pollock, right? And I think that the state capitalism thesis represents a decisive turning point in critical theory because Pollock posits a new primacy of the political. He argues in that essay that in state capitalism, the contradictions of capitalism have been overcome and brought under control by state governments in different ways, you know, in the Soviet Union, in fascism, in Western, you know, state capitalist society. So there's a kind of primacy of the political, which means that Marx's categories are no longer relevant, right? Marx is writing about a capitalist society which has an independent dynamic, right? And if that independent dynamic of capital ceases to exist, if in fact there's a primacy of politics, then Marx's theory is really no longer relevant in many ways, right? And so I think that this leads to a kind of deep pessimism that you see in Dialect of Enlightenment, and it reflects, Dialect of Enlightenment reflects the conditions of a mid-20th century state capitalism in a way that the earlier critical theory of the 1930s does not, right? So this is why I actually think that the early critical theory from the 1930s is in some ways more, actually more relevant to us today, because it's based on an analysis of liberal capitalism, monopoly capitalism, and it's not really based on the state capitalism that we see in the mid-20th century and on up into the 50s and 60s. In a way, also, I think Habermas's theory, you know, theory of communicative action, is also still heavily grounded in this kind of more optimistic, you know, view of the golden age period of mid-20th century capitalism. So I actually think that, you know, the early critical theory from the 30s and, you know, some of the analyses, you know, the authoritarian personality and, you know, Leo Löwenthal and Norbert Guterman's Prophets of Deceit are also grounded in Horkheimer's analysis of historical, and Eric Fromm as well, analysis of the socio-historical and social-psychological conditions that gave rise to fascism, you know, in an essay like Egoism and Freedom Movements on the Anthropology of the Bourgeois Epoch, or Fromm's Introduction to the Studies on Authority and Family, which was published in 1936. This introductory essay by Fromm is very important, I think, today for making sense of the social psychology of right-wing populist movements. And it's an essay that was just recently published, translated and published in English for the first time. So I would say that all of these writings remain very helpful. And of course, they need to be updated, just as Horkheimer himself would certainly have argued. We need more empirical studies of what's happening today. But I think there's a theoretical framework there in terms of social psychology and critique of capitalism that's still very relevant.
So thank you very much, John. We are unfortunately running out of time our format gives us. So, I mean, there is a lot yet to discuss about this kind of possibilities to revisit this concept. And I will highly recommend our listeners to read some of your papers that we will give on our website where you can find them. And just in this moment, I would like you to thank you very, very much, John, that you shared your time with us and that we had this possibility to get this insight about the question, how far we just need to read authoritarian personality to figure out what is happening today. So maybe we should really read it and then discuss it further on. Thank you, John.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.